we welcome in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. His latest book, which we will talk about in depth today, is part of the 33 and a Third series. It is Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. Hello there, Colin.
Rich Guy Kimball and the Soulful Sea Dog. Arf, arf.
I love it. I love it. In the book, I told you, just so great. It takes you to that moment in 1963, but the writing is on a level with the quality of the music. But let's talk a bit about this album itself, recorded in 1963. Why did it take so long for the public to get to hear this music?
I think it's simple in some ways, and one of those ways is that this was not the Sam Cooke that the then public was accustomed to. And I think I imagine they're still around, oldie stations. Cooke was this like staple of that genre at the time. And it's funny because we talk about like an oldie station now and you think this bygone era, but it was always more of a style of music, I'd say, in some ways, than like a dating technique. And so in terms of like an age technique. And so Cooke was that African-American singer that America preferred at the time as a kind of like Nat King Cole crooner. So that was safer in some senses to the American sensibility. And you could have your suburban daughter, Patty, have her friends over for the slumber party and the giggles and the gaggles and all of that. And you would listen to Sam Cooke records. And they tended to be quite lush, but his voice would rise above the orchestration. But that's the Sam Cooke that was the Sam Cooke, even as he morphed, that America knew for a while. And so this is 1963. It's early 1963. The album is recorded with the intention of not just being some like souvenir, but coming out. And it was at odds with what America knew as the Sam Cooke at the time. Now, it's not that much at odds with Sam Cooke of the Soul Stars when he was there in 1955, and we've talked about that performance when he's singing at the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles, but it was shelved, I'd say, really for its earthiness and for being at odds with the expectations that people had when it came to Sam Cooke.
It's also an album that meant a great deal to you and continues to, and you talk about that in the book as well, and the power and the strength that it enabled you to find in yourself.
I think something that I was very conscious of, and I'm always conscious of this, and I think that not many writers are, because I think sometimes what will happen is something will mean something for a particular person. It means a lot to them for whatever reason. And they think in and of itself that that's reason to be discussing that particular point. And so I don't write that way. If I'm going to use first person, it has to be because I'm talking about not really so much as something as how it pertains to me, but this other aspect, this thisness of a thing, this thing that we can all tap into. And I might just be using that light first person as a way to get there. But it's even like if you're writing memoir, you can't just be about, I care about this because it happened to me. You have to give people 100% complete reason to find themselves in that. So I use this Cooke album in some ways to go into my own life, but really to talk about ideas beyond my life, and even really ideas beyond this particular album. Because you're never really writing about the thing you're writing about, I don't think. You're creating your own work of art. You're using it maybe as a character, as a setting, as a springboard, but you also don't want anyone really catching on to that. They don't want you to think, you don't want them to think that you're using something for your own kind of methodology. So this is an album that has meant something to me at different points in my life and meant different things in different ways. And I think that's what the best art does. Like when I write a story like Fitty, or I do Meatheads, or I do Dark March, or whatever it is, I want someone to like love that work all the time. But I want them to love it differently at different times in their own life. And I think the best art, it grows along with us because it's actually part of the living of our life. It's not just this entertainment, and it can be that. But it's something that's like, hey, you've changed, and now you experience me differently. So I experienced this record one way when I was in college. And college wasn't for me, and I was writing professionally for the first time. And I experienced it a different way after I had my life fall apart and what I thought was the worst possible way at the time. I had no friends, I had no family, I'd had a stroke, I had a wife who just left me, and I was drinking far too much and getting up at these ungodly hours, like 3 in the morning. It's kind of when I get up now without the drinking, and walking 20 miles across Boston, I would listen to this album. But it's not like, oh, look at me, look at how hard I listened to this. It's like, let's get into these ideas. And here's like a portal, a door that we can use to get at some of them.
You talk about Cook, and I had never either noticed it or thought of it before, and how Sam Cook is not a character in his own songs. And you say that's because using that I, much like in your writing, can be too limiting.
Definitely. I think so. And Sam Cook was similar to Dylan in a lot of ways. And I think people find that a strange comparison. I don't think they'd find it a strange comparison after they read this particular book. But Sam Cook, he covered Blowing in the Wind. And they were both guys who sat there. We don't think of Sam Cook this way, do we? We don't think of him sitting there with a guitar in a chair and like writing whatever he's going to write, whether it's You Send Me or Change Is Going to Come or Chain Gang, whatnot. But that's what he did. And we don't think of him that way because we never see him with an instrument, well, beyond his voice. And so I think that's something people do with Dylan. It's certainly something they did with the early Dylan. You listen to Don't Think Twice, It's All Right. It's like, oh, Bob had a bad breakup. And you can't do that. I mean, in some ways, Kimball, even when I'm here and I'm talking with you and I use I and me, I'm not lying to anyone, but I'm also... I'm making something. I'm not just like, I don't know if I ever really just have like a conversation where it's like blah, 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 blah. I'm always conscious of just something beyond myself. And I think that's how I connect with people. That's what I offer the world, that I'm in sync with something beyond myself that maybe other people don't have. And I and me, they can become really powerful pronouns. It's almost like alignment, just getting down and getting a good stance in the dirt and pushing off and going after that quarterback. You can push hard with an I or a me. And there are also personal pronouns where it's like, huh, that guy's really being intimate with me. But they're also possessive of this universality. And even though, ironically, it's someone else's I or me, we have a tendency to be like, oh, yeah, I hear you, brother, man. I've definitely gone through that myself. And so then the I and the me, when used adroitly, it becomes a giant we. No reader is left behind. No listener is left behind. That's what I try to do, and I think that's what Sam Cook tried to do as well.
Colin Fleming talking with us about his book, Sam Cook, Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. The album itself, a remarkable start to this album in that Cook lets King Curtis kind of take the lead on his own hit, to kick off the album with Soul Twist. And then we meet a very different Sam Cooke that, as you said, than most of America was accustomed to hearing and seeing.
We do, but it's interesting because if you actually know the career of Sam Cooke, you're always meeting a new Sam Cooke. Mm. And this album is like the melting point, I think, of his different tributaries and his roads and all of that kind of stuff, where we're getting this confluence. All the rivers are coming together, and here's like the Sam Cooke ocean kind of thing. But there's a lot of difference from You Send Me to the Nightbeat album that we've talked about before. And he was someone who was always changing. Now, what's interesting about Cooke, and I don't think people really pick up on this, he's the only original rock and soul person, for the most part, from like 55, 56, 57, that era, especially 56 and 57, who's going to make it to the era of the Beatles and the Stones. Now, other people are going to come back, but like Jerry Lee Lewis, he's like, oh, I love my teenage cousin. Elvis goes off to the army. Chuck Berry goes to jail. Buddy Holly dies. So Sam Cooke is like the holdover. I know you have like holdovers like Bo Diddley, but he was more of a kind of like margin guy than he was like, oh, it's Bo Diddley's latest hit on the radio. I know he had some hits, but it wasn't the same as like a Sam Cooke hit. It wasn't as ubiquitous. Like, cool people knew Bo Diddley, but a lot of people who just weren't that cool and like vaguely paid attention to what was going on around them, they heard Sam Cooke. So you get Sam Cooke when he comes to this night, this January night in Miami's quote-unquote colored section of Overtown in 63. You're getting these different cooks. You're getting the cook of the work song sort of type of songwriting. You're getting Sam Cooke, who's found a way to take the soul, rather the twist craze, which should have been so limiting, and turn it into the sonata form that actually empowers his writing. You're getting gospel Sam Cooke. You're getting secular Sam Cooke. You're getting all of these different mashups of Sam Cooke because he's in flux and he's on his way. He's writing in the moment and he's in moving all the time to what's going to be, well, his ultimate moment. But I don't think that ultimate moment and change is going to come is going to happen without not just nights like this particular show, but this album itself, which I think meant something to me, approached it a different way, knowing that they were recording.
You make a distinction in the book, Colin, that Cooke made, which was that he didn't talk about recording gospel music. He referred to it as spiritual music. What was that difference?
It was a big difference for him. And we might think like, oh, Sam Cooke splitting that hair. But I think he looked at gospel music as having that implied, that specifically implied religious aspect to it. So it was like, who's your God? What's your faith? What's your religion? That kind of thing. Whereas a spiritual music is a music of outdoors. And that goes back to the 19th century when if you were a field hand, you'd be singing not just work songs, but you'd be singing spirituals quite literally in the field. It wasn't just within the house of worship. And I think Sam Cooke was very keen to have that idea of his music traveling, of it not to be bound by four walls and a roof. I don't think he was interested in that. I think he was interested in maximum connectivity. And so if that's going to be what you're about, you're going to want to strip back, step clear of label. I mean, I do it all the time. We talk about these dating sites, like these horrible, horrible people I meet. One of the first things, if they should find out I'm a writer, that they'll ask is what genre? And I mean, you would laugh. I mean, you don't like have to, like how do I even? I invent new modes of communication and storytelling. Like, how do you even go into it? Like, you can't really go into it because they just expect you to say like, oh, politics or young adult literature or whatever it is. And that's just so limiting if you don't have like that kind of limitation in your ability. So I think Cooke was very self-aware of what he could do and what he was going to change into. He was always in the process of morphing. And this night, this album is like a freeze frame of that actual process of change, of evolution.
And he's got that audience at the Harlem Square Club in Miami eating out of the palm of his hand, but at the same time, and you're right about this, he even refers to the future in some of his patter, his onstage conversation, when he talks about the people who will hear this recording in the future.
He does. It's very Doctor Who. It's almost like he's pausing the night, and he's going in the TARDIS. He's like, I'll be right back. He's like, he goes and he sees the future. And he comes back. He's like, oh, I get real good. Like, it's not anything. And I mean, I know you have some like hesitation oftentimes with live recordings. I have always loved the idea of live recordings because I'm an energy person. And when you say that you're an energy person, people are like, rah, rah. That's not what I mean. There's great energy in the writing of Proust. There's great energy in Schubert, who comes up a lot in this book, which you wouldn't think could come up in a book with Sam Cooke, but there are all these different things that come up, hockey, all of these things. And people might think, wow, you can't do that. Read the book, be like, huh, that does actually make perfect sense. But Cooke was an energy person because energy, again, is about reaching beyond yourself to impel people, to give them a reason to care. But the idea that he could be in that sort of like Dickensian, the Christmas Carol sense, he's in the past. He's certainly in the moment. He's like Michael Jordan, game six of the finals, locked in the moment. But he's also like moving towards his future. I was writing in the blog. It'll go up later tonight. I haven't put it up yet, but I was like mid-writing this. And I was discussing the idea of like talking about this Sam Cooke book because it's strange to me. It's not something I could do if I didn't have 50 other things that I was presently working on, because it's the shift from the last game for me. Do you know what I mean? It's
right.
Not, it's in the past. And I believe in living your life and creating like a thrown knife. And that's sort of like, that's my thing. And so for me to even be talking about something and talking about it in like a different way and have that be its own worthwhile creation, I can only do that even when I'm in the moment, if I'm also in this other moment, which sounds like a contradiction, but I think Cooke was that way. And we can hear the oral evidence of that. And I don't know how you can listen to this record and think like, well, he's distracted. But I also don't see how you can listen to it and be like, huh, he's not building towards the future, because he obviously is.
The energy that's present in that crowd and in his performance, to me, it elevates these songs and perhaps, well, two in particular, but Chain Gang. And as you point out, it's become such a part of the oldies canon. We play it on this station all the time that I think sometimes we forget the moment that it was birthed into the world. How in the world was this song everywhere in 1960 when you listen to the power and those lyrics?
How is it out then? How is it played in all of these years since?
Mm.
I mean, we can look at it as like a bouncier, more rhythmically driving, faster pace, Strange Fruit.
Right.
I mean, and it's like, that's the subject. And it's like, you're not going to go there. He's like, oh, yeah, I got a timeshare there. Like, he went there. And it was born of this kind of like real life experience he had. He wasn't a chain gang himself, obviously, but the tour bus. The tour bus is like crucial. It's interesting to like a couple of his songs. The Change Is Gonna Come is another one of them. But they have this experience where they come across like a chain gang. He writes this. And it sounds like, you know, like that quote John Lennon, it's like, I'm the walrus. He's like, George Martin, I want to sound like I'm on a mountain, I'm a monk, and I'm like chanting, and there are 1,000 monks around me. It kind of sounds like that. Sam Cooke, those background singers in this song, they do sound like they actually hired a chain gang.
Mm.
And it's this intense rhythmic number. But when I think of like Sam Cooke on the oldies station, because that's how I was first exposed to Sam Cooke. Like, I always knew who he was, because 8 or 9 years old, and you're in the car, and you're going to see, like, Grandma. I remember You Send Me, and Chain Gang, and Wonderful World was another one, because Wonderful World was perfect for the oldies format, because it was a song that itself was about nostalgia, even though it was phrased in the subjunctive, which was so clever, because it was a song that looked back by moving forward. And you don't expect that. That's how well and how genius Sam Cooke wrote. But you get this song, and then you get it within this live context. And I mean, have you ever heard like a more somatic, although he does kind of actually up it on the record, but somatic, a record of the body. It sounds like he is just thrusting his hips through the night air, through your speakers. It's like, whoa, Sam Cooke, you got to step back there a bit. That's crazy.
Oh, and as you point out, the patter, which is often done in a singing fashion, is just, it just weaves everything together. And boy, there's not much more powerful. And as you point out in the book, it's so powerful, they don't even list it on the track listing on the record label. But when he ventures into this live version of You Send Me that leads into Bring It On Home to Me, good Lord, that's just, it's breathtaking.
That's almost too much. And it's like, there have been 3 different versions of this album. And there's not like, it's not like one has more tracks than the other. So like, people are like, oh, wow, get the complete thing. So any of them have the complete thing. It's what you would have heard. This was the second show of the night, kind of a grail that we don't have the tape, at least not yet, of the first one. But You Send Me was the song where, I think that was the first song where people knew who Sam Cooke was outside of that Soul Stirrers, his group that he really became too big for. I think that's and I think it's still probably the song, I mean, even more than A Change Is Gonna Come, which is the much more consequential song. But I still think it's probably his best known song, which really doesn't mean a lot. I mean, like Strawberry Fields Forever was in Penny Lane, best single of all time, was like number 8 in the charts. It was the first Beatles single in like all these releases not to make number 1. They didn't even really care. And I don't think like a change is going to come. It doesn't matter. Like once you sell a certain amount of a record, it doesn't matter whether it's 13 million or like 7 million or 4 million. It matters that it's out there. And I think sometimes the record that sells less but still hits a significant number can actually do more because it means more to those people and it travels better. So I think that's what happened in that Beatles example. But You Send Me is discussed as an idea in the book, the idea of Cook being this self-sender. And he was always sending himself off on these new journeys. And I think in some ways, journeys that continue now still in our age, in 2021, in his music. And I discuss his demo version of You Send Me, which is a lot different than the version that we all know that plays on the radio. And then this version from the show is not even listed because it's so sonically unrecognizable. Like, take that, Dylan. He's doing Tangled Up in Blue different. And, like, you don't know what it is right away. That they don't even, like, label it on any of the three releases. It's not even, like, 1 for 3. One sort of nailed it. And it becomes this, how do you even describe it? Like, this churning, bluesy, proto-hip-hop. And his voice becomes louder with volume swelling chords. One of the cool things about his singing on this record is sometimes you don't know if he's technically singing or he's technically talking. It's like when Mozart was doing operas, like, I am going to have the singers talk sometimes. And people are like, hey, Moz, you can't be doing that. He's like, I think I can. I'm calling it the magic flute. You'll dig it. It's cool. Sam Cooke does the soul version of that on this. And then when you think, like, it can't be topped, and he hits this note, and it's so loud, the band kicks into Bring It On Home to Me. And the original, the studio version, it swings so hard. What he does, it's almost like it hurts so good, kind of.
Oh, yeah.
That he's swinging it so relentlessly, and you're almost like, I can't take this anymore, man, but sock it to me, bad boy.
And to me, what makes the studio version work is the Lou Rawls impact. But man, he's doing it just by himself with the band, and it's about as physical and as sexual, I think, as music can get.
And it's not like the way the Animals are going to do it, which is how I really started against Sam Cooke, because it's this hymn at the same time. For forgiveness, and not him asking, not the singer asking for forgiveness, but the singer willing to extend forgiveness to somebody who's been unfaithful. And there aren't a lot of examples of that in art, and there aren't a lot of examples of that in rock and roll. You get an example of it with The Who's A Quick One While He's Away, and sometimes that was played almost tongue-in-cheek. If you listen to the 1968 live version from the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, it's like this benediction of forgiveness. It's one of the most intense, I put it on the level of this album, one of the most intensely emotional performances you can ever hear. But Cook is doing both the call and he's doing the response. And sometimes when he needs a third voice, and I've never heard anyone do this. I wrote about this. I couldn't wait to write about this. He actually takes his fist and he hits his own chest to create this third echo. It's like, my goodness, like just giving yourself to the music. Who would even think to do that? And you have to listen carefully. But once you notice it, it's like, wow, I'm going to try that when I do it myself in the shower. And the water will just go flying. But it's like, I've never heard someone like that committed in a moment to the moment of that music making. And still, even with this show, there's still more to come.
One of the things that I was really fascinated about in the book, Colin, was your discussion about his use of, the letter A and the sound ah, which is so important to this performance. Can you explain that a little bit?
And Cook does things where he finds space within words. It's almost like splitting the atom create the bomb. Cook, for instance, will often, throughout his career, and he does it with different levels of intensity, different intentions too, he'll take these A sounds, these certain syllables. It's like his go-to kind of syllable. He likes that A syllable, and he'll stretch it, or he'll split it into two different syllables, and he generates a lot of like torque and power and emphasis from that. It's almost like Mark Antony's speech in Julius Caesar, the way he uses repetition. Cook is able to find that kind of dynamic rhythm of repetition sans actually repeating himself, which is a pretty neat trick. And so you know he means business when he's splitting those syllables that way, when he's using that A syllable. And that A syllable is something that he builds constantly throughout this show. And he does it to a much more pronounced degree than anywhere else in his career. We see evidence of it at other points in his career. And then it reaches its apogee point in A Change Is Gonna Come. Like, you can actually take the way he is handling vowels and the way he's handling this very particular vowel, and you can make that direct connection between this night in January 1963 and what I will say is the most important song ever written in this country's history, which doesn't happen without this night. And I don't even think it's enough to say without nights like this, because I think, again, that the tapes were rolling brought out something different in him, that it was going to be like this recorded art in the actual moment of its making, and that would be something to build off of. But I've certainly never heard anyone sing that way. Singers have like go to sounds or go to syllables or go to just adverbs, that kind of thing, and you notice their little habits. But this is one that really stands apart.
And you point out that he didn't go to a falsetto voice very often, but he does. But you believe that happened on the spot. That wasn't planned, and maybe he wasn't even sure about it himself, but caught up in the power of the moment.
You know that guy, like in high school, who can dunk, but only during the game,
right?
Can't like dunk like during practice, and I think that because Sam Cooke and I remember when I was doing this book, which I wrote this in 15 days. I mean, I wrote, and I was writing everything else. Maybe that was something that, like, you're not supposed to talk about at the time, but well, I probably did. But it's something I'm okay talking about now, because I wrote this in 15 days while I was doing all of these other things, the op-eds and stories. And sometimes I go 3 days without writing a story, and I'd feel like a loser, and I'd make myself write, like, a new 3,000-word story before I work some more on this. But Cook, I was noticing how everyone was talking about him during the early stages, like the first 2 days, that he was this best singer of all time. And if you're going by his actual range, well, he's not. And the comparison that I make is Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald. And I'm hopefully doing this book soon on Billie Holiday. She comes up throughout the book a lot. But she was nowhere near a singer, technique-wise, that Ella Fitzgerald was. Ella Fitzgerald could sing circles around her. I mean, Paul McCartney could sing circles around John Lennon, but has there like been a better rock and roll singer than Lennon? He had the quintessential voice. It didn't mean that he didn't have range. But Cook, he was like Holiday. He was someone who sung as a storyteller who made an emotional and I think also a very clear intellectual connection with listeners. Because as much as I love Ella Fitzgerald, I think a lot of people do, and as much as I love Billie Holiday, you don't really hear people talk about that connection to Ella Fitzgerald's art the way you do Billie Holiday's art. And people connected with Sam Cooke that way. But he wouldn't be a guy who's like, okay, I can just do this range. Like, you can listen to a silly Beatles song like Why Don't We Do It in the Road. Paul McCartney's range is all over the map. I mean, Lennon could never do that. Sam Cooke could never do just something like that. So it's almost like, it's like that pitcher on the mound. It's late in the game, and he knows he's coming out, and he's topped out at like 93 that night. And then all of a sudden, he finds 98 in his back pocket, and like Eckersley's like, "Wow, that was some great cheese." Well, that's what Sam Cooke, I think, has moved to do, where he has this falsetto near the end of this gig that I'm not even sure he knew necessarily that he had in him at the time.
remarkable music and a remarkable book that takes you right there to that night in 1963 in Miami. Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963, Sam Cooke, part of the 33 and a third series. It is great stuff. Colin, thank you as always for talking in depth about it with us this afternoon. We'll visit with you again next week.
Okay, sounds good, sir.
Colin Fleming in downtown.